Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. This week, we're bringing you stories written and produced by students from the semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story exploring either health or science. As you might guess, the topics varied widely, ranging from midwifery to electronic health records to waste treatment. In our first three reports, we'll hear from Tom McClough on robots that perform surgery, Roxanne Palmer on the study of bats, and to start, Rick Daschle has this story on a lab at MIT developing cutting-edge prosthetics.
Joe Lamar walks into a Dunkin' Donuts in Taunton, Massachusetts. At first glance, Lamar is athletically built, with fair skin and a quick smile under a neatly trimmed mustache. But there's a hitch in its gait when he sits down, on account of his prosthetic leg. It's barely noticeable, and Lamar laughs off the notion that people with artificial limbs have a distinct walk.
Nowadays, people don't even know. If I'm wearing pants out in public, people would not have a clue that I'm an amputee.
Lamar's artificial right leg is fitted just below the knee. His leg was amputated in 1990 because of a cancerous tumor, but Lamar says he's adapted gradually to the prosthesis.
Now in my life, I've been using a prosthetic for more than half of my life. And it's something that you adapt to, you get used to. I look at what motivates me is knowing that people do have it harder than I do.
His prosthesis is not the most sophisticated on the market. Because of that, Lamar often deals with back pain, since he no longer has an ankle to absorb some of the impact when he walks.
The slightest change in walking gaits at times does give you that, and it's definitely uncomfortable.
Lamar may have to deal with those issues now, but in the near future, he may not have to. The Media Lab at MIT is housed in a shiny metal building. It's a mixture of hard edges and rounded corners. Inside, high-tech research takes place in keycard-accessible laboratories. It's here that Hugh Herr, the director of biomechatronics, works on motorized prosthetics called hybrids. They create a more fluid range of motion and walking gait. Herr is close to 6 feet tall and fit. His two prosthetic legs are only noticeable in an unusual twist in his hips when he rounds a corner. His office is cluttered with hybrid prostheses in different states of completion. On his walls hang posters of mountain ranges, showcasing his other passion and the initial reason he got into the business. He lost both legs in a mountaineering accident in 1982.
Yeah, I was fitted with prostheses probably 2 months after my limb amputations, and they were uncomfortable. And fairly non-adaptive. So I was shocked, actually. I thought there had to be something better than what was provided me.
One of the functions of HERS lab is figuring out the mechanics of movement.
There's the data collection of how people move and how we walk and run, jump, you know, maybe fly at some point.
That's Michael Eilenberg, a graduate student at MIT and Professor HERS research assistant.
We have a gait lab called the holodeck, just like in Star Trek, and this is basically a big room with a bunch of motion capture cameras, very expensive cameras, that put out infrared light and then bounces off these little reflective markers on your body.
The camera images are converted into animated action that allows researchers to calculate the various forces at work during different types of movement.
We can not only get the motions of people doing normal things, walking, running, climbing stairs, whatever that might be, but in addition, we can back calculate out the torques and the forces associated with those movements.
That information goes into many computers in the prosthetic, creating more lifelike movement.
We have a powered ankle-foot prosthesis that has three computers on it and 12 sensors, and it adapts as you walk.
With advances like these at MIT, the gap between what can be done and what can be imagined is quickly shrinking.
While time travel and flying cars may be futuristic fantasies, robot surgeons are a reality now, and they're altering the way doctors perform surgery. While these robot-assisted surgeries still have a man or woman behind the machine, this growing technology promises to increase precision and decrease patient recovery times. At Boston University Medical Center, the robots perform surgery several times a day. The large white machine looks like a giant claw that comes out of the ground and hangs over the patient. Interchangeable tools such as scissors, knives, clamps, and a camera can be connected to the machine's fingers and inserted into small holes in the patient. The tools are controlled by a surgeon using his hands, fingers, and feet to operate the machine from a nearby console. the robot is designed to be steadier than the human hand and have a larger range of motion while decreasing the size of entry incisions. Prostate surgery is currently the most commonly performed type of robot-assisted surgery. But while there are many benefits to this minimally invasive, video game-like surgery, research shows the results are far from perfect. A recent study comparing robot-assisted prostate surgery to traditional surgery found there were both benefits and drawbacks with the robot procedure. Dr. Jim Hu from Brigham and Women's Hospital was the lead author on the study.
The positive findings in favor of the minimally invasive approaches were that the length of stay on average was 1 day shorter. It was 2 versus 3 days. So people got out of the hospital sooner. They were also much less likely to need a blood transfusion compared to the open approach. On the flip side, it was more frequently diagnosed in men after minimally invasive surgery that they might have erectile dysfunction or incontinence.
However, Dr. Hu says most drawbacks to the robot-assisted surgery are not because of the machinery, but are due to a lack of training and experience of the surgeons. The FDA only requires a 2-day course and several supervised surgeries before a doctor becomes certified to use the robot. Dr. Hu has performed hundreds of robot-assisted procedures and says it takes more than the minimum requirements to master the machine.
You know, one analogy is just if you go from, you know, riding a bicycle to driving a stick shift. You know, you don't do it in a very facile way after just a 2-day course.
Dr. Hu is not alone in this thinking. Dr. Robert Poston, chief of cardiac surgery at Boston Medical Center, has also used the robot extensively for heart surgery. He says practice is not only important for the surgeon, but for anyone helping in the operating room.
The training is a very important aspect of this that is often overlooked. Developing the team is something that is often allowed to just happen on its own, whereas it should be actively managed.
The robot can be used for heart surgery, specifically during bypasses for high-risk patients, including those who are diabetic, have bad lungs, or are on blood thinners. When done properly, Dr. Poston says robot assistance is ideal for heart surgery. It allows for a steadier, more maneuverable hand, and it lets doctors avoid cutting through the patient's sternum and opening up the entire chest cavity, which is necessary for traditional heart surgery. It also means recoveries are measured in days or weeks instead of months. While immediate recovery is certainly quicker, it's the long-term results that truly matter. Dr. Poston is reluctant to call robot surgery superior because it's only been in use since 2000 and the jury is still out.
It's wonderful if you can get out of the hospital in 3 days and have no scar, but if you don't ultimately have a good bypass operation, then it was all for naught.
Dr. Poston says he is looking at the long-term effectiveness of the robot-assisted procedures before recommending it to all of his patients who might benefit.
Student reporter Tom McClouf. Before that, we heard from Rick Dashle. Now here's Roxanne Palmer with a story about bat research that could lead to new designs in military aircraft.
A crime-fighting bat might seem like comic book fantasy, but it's no joke to the U.S. Air Force. Their Department of Scientific Research supports labs at U.S. colleges that investigate the flying capabilities of bats. One such lab is headed by Sharon Swartz, a professor of biology at Brown University.
In a world where the Air Force would have lots of different kinds of unmanned vehicles, I think it's very appealing to them to envision having some vehicles that are very naturalistic, including some that would, especially at some distance, look to especially to an untrained eye, would look a little bit like an animal.
The Air Force thinks that small vehicles modeled after bats may also have an advantage in navigating complex environments, like a city street in Iraq or a cave system on the Afghanistan border. Swartz's research could lead to designs for these unmanned air vehicles. In Swartz's lab, located in the basement of a large biomedical complex, a group of Jamaican fruit bats is about to show off their moves.
What we have down in the basement here is a kind of obstacle course for bats.
The bats are light brown, with a funny nose that looks kind of like a third ear. Their wingspan is about 2 hands wide. Swartz releases the bats at one end of the course, where a series of plexiglass panels form a kind of three-dimensional maze. Though they have little clearance between the walls of the maze, the bats turn on a dime, sometimes pirouetting in midair, before somersaulting up to the ceiling, where they land upside down. Swartz says it's the structure of their wing that helps them perform such complex maneuvers.
Bats are really kind of different than both birds and insects. Bird wings have just a couple of joints, and insect wings have really no joints at all. There's a hinge at what the equivalent of an insect shoulder would be, but then everything between that kind of shoulder or hinge and the tip of the wing is inert.
Bat wings also display the signs of their evolutionary lineage. Their wings are more like human hands than the wings of birds or insects.
If we look at our own hand, we can see that there's all those joints there, you know, more than a dozen joints in a human hand. And a bat, similarly, has more than a dozen joints in its wing.
Those extra joints mean more points at which the bat can control its wing. Bats also have special muscles in their wings that run through the skin.
What these muscles appear to be able to do is by contracting and relaxing, they can change the stiffness of the membrane.
These features add up to a creature that's a veritable aerial acrobat. Applying Swartz's research to military technology is still only at the conceptual stage. Someday, though, we may get to see crime-fighting bats outside of comics.
That was student reporter Roxanne Palmer. Before that, we heard from Tom McClough and Rick Daschle. In a bit, we'll hear from Tinker Reddy on the realities of implementing national electronic health records. Next up, Christina Sorensen has a story on something no parent wants to see on his or her own child.
Heather Sundahl knew that there had been several cases of head lice in her children's school in Belmont, but it was December, Christmas was coming, and she hadn't really given it much thought until that moment when something caught her eye.
It's Christmas Eve, and we're sitting there at church, and I'm sitting there stroking my daughter's hair and just listening to the lovely music, and then I see something out of the corner of my eye kind of dart across her part. I'm like, what is that? And then I look, and they're just everywhere. Her head is infested with lice.
Health professionals all agree that head lice aren't dangerous. They don't carry diseases or cause pain. At most, they can cause an itchy scalp. But some 12 million people in the U.S. get them every year, and getting rid of them is tough. Each female louse can live for about a month, laying about 6 eggs per day. Pesticides and oils can kill the live bugs, but they don't kill all of the eggs. If even a couple of eggs get left behind, they soon hatch, and within a few weeks, a whole new colony of head lice is established. Barrett Pratt is a school nurse in Cambridge. She also founded a company called Nitwits that treats head lice. Pratt says she's seen many clients who've tried standard head lice treatments only to have the bugs come back.
Most pediatricians say the same thing, vacuum the whole house and use the over-the-counter shampoo. 95% of the people who come to us have already done that, and it hasn't worked. Reason being, the bugs are resistant to the shampoo, and it's all about mechanical removal and getting the eggs out.
The eggs, which are also called nits, are tiny, about the size of a grain of sand. Each nit is cemented to an individual strand of hair. The traditional way of getting these eggs out is nitpicking, working through the hair in small sections and pulling off the nits using the fingernails or a special nit comb. Many health professionals, including Barrett Pratt, say they find it helpful to use hair conditioner when removing lice and nits.
What we used to do more is we used to do more picking, but that took a huge amount of time. So now we find that putting in a conditioner and combing is much more effective, and it takes less time.
Pratt tells clients not to worry about vacuuming everything, but to focus on removing the nits. She advises them to do a thorough combing 3 times a week for 3 weeks, using either hair conditioner or olive oil and a special fine-toothed metal comb. These repeated treatments, she says, will catch any remaining lice before they have a chance to lay more eggs. But even when people get rid of every last louse and each tiny nit, the emotional effects of an infestation may continue.
We talk about having PTLD, post-traumatic lice disorder.
For Heather Sundahl, the effects lingered for years.
If you're watching a TV show and you see two people hugging or sharing a brush or someone trying on hats, you're like, oh, what are you thinking? What are you doing? Don't do it. Don't do it. You know, you just sort of are imagining that there's lice everywhere and that, you know, at any moment they could get you.
Fortunately, not all kids or parents are traumatized by head lice. Susan Schrader of Waltham says that her 6-year-old son, Rex, was actually delighted when the school nurse told him he had lice.
She's telling me and telling Rex that he has lice, and he just starts beaming. He says, oh, finally I have a pet. So I have a pet lice. I'm going to name him Licey.
Schrader explained to Rex that he could only have this new pet for an hour or so, and then they were going to have to put Licey down. They were headed out of the school doors when Rex saw his class.
So his class is walking by and he says, "Na, na, 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 I have lice. I'm out of here." He's just overjoyed that not only does he now have a pet named Licey, but Licey also gets him out of school early.
Rex says he realized that even a great louse like Licey couldn't stick around forever.
We got some time to know each other, but it was time to say goodbye.
Whether they consider them friend or foe, millions of people will also be trying to say goodbye to their head lice this year.
I don't know why you say goodbye. I say I love.
Healthcare reformers, including President Obama, are making big promises for what they call health information technology, or HIT. With HIT, computers in hospitals, doctors' offices, labs, and patients' homes will be able to share medical records. The system has the potential to cut costs, improve patient care, and prevent deadly medical mistakes. When the federal government announced it would spend nearly $50 billion in stimulus money to create medical computer networks, Maryland doctor Ross Martin turned on his metronome and wrote a song to celebrate.
I want to get in the act of high-tech, honey, and help build the network for interoperability.
But can computers bring harmony to healthcare? Three towns in Massachusetts, North Adams, Brockton, and Newburyport, volunteered for a three-year experiment in setting up a wired healthcare system. They knew it wouldn't be easy, and they were right. The pilot project, launched in 2005, ended late last year. But only one of the three towns turned the reformers' hopes into reality. Rural North Adams used a single health record system to successfully connect 60 doctors and one hospital. But in Brockton, a larger city with two competing hospitals, they pretty much gave up when they hit connectivity problems and ran out of time and money. Newburyport on the North Shore had mixed results with the pilot project. Yes, most doctors are now using electronic medical records, but because they use software from four different companies, no one could figure out how to patch the various systems together. Richard Mendes, a Newburyport orthopedist who ran the project for 4 years, said it was akin to the disconnect between Apples and PCs in the early days of personal computing.
They're both computers, they both store information, they both have it in digital format, but they don't talk to each other very well. So if Dr. A and B both have electronic records, but the electronic record A and B don't speak to each other, then you're really no better off than you were with the paper.
Ideally, when a heart patient shows up in an emergency department in the middle of the night, the ER doctor would have access to records from the patient's primary care doctor and cardiologist.
In a situation like that, it's very important that Dr. B knows what Dr. A was doing, that the doctor in the emergency room knows what the other two doctors are doing, and ultimately, as you go forward, that whoever is taking care of you knows what all three, what happened in each of those three venues.
But without the ability to connect to a primary care doctor's computer, the cardiologist can't find out what medications you are on, and the ER doctor might just have to repeat an expensive scan you had just last week. And Mendes says the only electronic information doctors can get out of the hospital now are lab tests and x-rays. The labs at Anna Jakes Hospital in Newburyport were already digitized when the HIT project began. Technician Janet McBride stands at a computer screen checking results of tests for problems like high cholesterol or faulty liver function.
So as soon as the tests are done, they come across the screen on the computer, and the technologist will review them and let them go, and they go right into the computer. There's no manual entry anymore.
Before that, information just stayed in the hospital. Now, she says, doctors have instant access to it.
They don't have to call us for the results. Before, it would go into our computer system, but they wouldn't be able to get in and see it. So it's changed because they can log on, and as soon as the results are released, they can see them. I don't have to read people, you know, doctor scrawls anymore. I can just look at the computer-generated sheet.
That's actually a big deal. One of the promises of HIT is that it will reduce medical errors, and doctors' bad handwriting can lead to the wrong test or the wrong dose. Matt Whalen now runs Wellport, the nonprofit that took control of the Newburyport system when the pilot project ended earlier this year. He says funding, connectivity, and other technical issues limited what they could achieve. For example, they were never able to set up a system to give patients access to their own records. So he agrees that the Newburyport HIT system didn't reach its goals. But he likes to think they just haven't gotten there yet.
We had a vision of what we wanted this to be, much like, you know, practicing, you know, thinking you're going to run a marathon and then getting into the race and only being able to make it 20 miles. So, you know, we're still here and we're, you know, gearing up for another race.
So the message to reformers is, What looks good in theory is not that easy to implement in the real world.
This is WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. We just heard from Tinker Reddy on some of the challenges to implementing national electronic health records. Before that, Christina Sorensen reported on the difficulties of eliminating head lice. In our last story, we'll hear from Celie Hart about the debate in Massachusetts over licensing midwives. First, though, Kate Steger takes an up-close look at the future of sewage treatment.
Unless you've lived without one, you may not fully appreciate the convenience of a flushing toilet. But unless you visited your local wastewater treatment plant, you may not fully appreciate the cost, both financial and environmental, of that convenience. Richard Clapp is a professor of environmental health at Boston University.
And it's one of these things that most people think out of sight, out of mind. Just make it go somewhere away.
This is our final effluent going over the disinfection weirs.
Charlie Tyler is one of the many people who share the responsibility for making it go somewhere. He's a program manager at the Deer Island Sewage Treatment Plant, which receives the waste that Boston residents flush away.
The first cultural divide is, oh, that's waste. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. I want to flush and forget it. That's all I want to do. I've done that all my life.
Clapp and Tyler both worry about one of the crushing problems of a flush-and-forget sewer system, flagrant, unchecked water consumption. Clapp says the days of polluting drinkable water with our waste will soon be over.
One of the next big environmental crises of the coming century is the lack of access to safe and fresh water. And so using a system to remove waste that is incredibly wasteful of water is going to create the pressure to figure out some other way of doing it.
Tyler says a failure to come up with sustainable solutions may lead to more than just pressure.
Water is going to be at such a premium that it's going to be the thing that people are fighting wars over in the not-too-distant future. I would love to be wrong on that, but if we don't figure out a different way to manage that resource, we're going to be in deep trouble over it.
Clean water comes to Boston from the Quabbin Reservoir in central Massachusetts. Wastewater is treated at Deer Island and then flushed out to sea. In order to keep up with the growth of the greater metropolitan area and to clean up Boston Harbor, Deer Island underwent a $3.8 billion renovation in the last few decades. But as Clapp points out, the plant is already outdated.
Well, it's out of date because, like any big industrial operation, it wears out. The metal parts wear out, the leaks continue. It gets too expensive to keep running it.
To conserve water, some communities around the country have begun to lay water reuse lines for things like flushing toilets, washing clothes, and watering lawns. But when a system is already so costly, major changes like these can be unfeasible.
What I see more likely to happen is more decentralization of things, so that big plants like Deer Island may start to become obsolete when you have, you know, water usage and treatment and return on the same property, in the same complex, then you're not sending it to a central collection area where it's being dumped into the ocean. You're conserving your water by having a little mini water cycle in your own backyard.
On-site solutions may work in the future, but they don't solve the environmental problems at Deer Island today. Laura Orlando, a civil engineer who also teaches at Boston University, says the current sewage infrastructure is over 100 years old and was not designed to handle the pollution of modern cities.
The disaster of sewers is that it mixes everything together, and there is no engineering, no best available technology to separate out everything going down the drain.
Orlando's concerned that Deer Island receives not just human waste, but waste from manufacturers and industrial businesses, as well as stormwater runoff from oily streets and pesticide-treated lawns. Clapp shares her concerns.
When industrial waste that includes toxic chemicals, persistent bioaccumulative toxins, for example, metals, when that's mixed with human waste, it's actually inseparable. So what comes out in the sludge is kind of a mix that often is unusable as even fertilizer because it contains too many pollutants.
We're pumping about 1,600 gallons a minute today over there of digested sludge, ready to be turned into fertilizer pellets.
Like all wastewater treatment plants, Deer Island has two byproducts, water and sludge. So in addition to moving billions of gallons of treated water under Boston Harbor to Massachusetts Bay, Deer Island also pumps copious amounts of sludge under the harbor to Quincy. When the Environmental Protection Agency outlawed ocean dumping of sludge in the 1980s, wastewater treatment facilities began to convert sludge into fertilizer for agricultural application. Many experts oppose this controversial practice, but EPA policy is slow to change.
You know, ultimately, we have to decide what to do with our own waste. And
that's what Cambridge resident Abby Rockefeller decided to do. In 1984, she installed composting toilets in her house and quit contributing to a system that she says stinks.
Now, the compost, if it's in there very, very long, the longer it's in there, the more mineralized it gets and the more
Clapp in Orlando recently brought a group of students to Rockefeller's house to see what a small-scale alternative to Deer Island might look like.
This is the best urinal in the world, just by the way. You're honored to be sitting.
The bathroom has an attractive wooden box along one wall containing two lidded chambers. Under one lid is a familiar white toilet seat over a dark hole that tapers to a round 4 to 5 inch hole. Under the other is a basket containing wood shavings to top off the sitter's excrement. Nearby is the thigh-high waterless urinal, an elegant piece of glazed pottery, which, except for the drain at the bottom, looks like it should hold a bouquet of gladiolas.
This opening here is for kitchen scraps.
On a wooden shelf in the hallway is a lidded opening for food scraps from the nearby kitchen, which deposits into the same chamber in Rockefeller's basement as the surprisingly odorless toilet. The odorless quality of the processed waste is one of the remarkable aspects of the vigorously inspected compost taken from the bins and passed around by the curious students below.
This is what's coming out of it. And everybody has to take a sniff.
As an avid gardener, Rockefeller is proud of her moist-rich compost, never mind that it came from human waste. What may have gone in as poop has clearly been transformed by the time it tumbles to the chamber's access door to a safe, inviting soil that smells like plain old dirt. The climate is so hospitable that it's become home to the creepy crawlies that every gardener loves to see, earthworms.
Ew! Just got a big clump of...
Rockefeller put 5 worms in the bin 15 years ago. Now that same bin contains millions of their offspring. The worms tell her that the chemical composition of her compost is healthy and well-balanced, and they also help keep the compost churning.
Whoa, there's a ton in here. That's crazy.
Let's say I appreciate them. What they think of me, I don't know.
Though handling the compost is rarely necessary, removing the compost tea, or neutralized urine, requires a regular commitment. About twice a year, Rockefeller empties the 200-gallon liquid storage container into 5-gallon jugs, which she takes to her garden in New Hampshire. In her opinion, changes in public policy could make this process less onerous to individuals and more feasible in an urban setting. A bigger problem is weaning people of the carefree convenience of their flush-and-forget toilets.
I work in the sewer, it's a very hard job. You know they won't hire just any old slob. You don't have to wear a tie or a coat. You just have to know how to float.
Jennifer Frankel says she barely remembers her husband recording the birth of their son last summer. Nolan, their third child, was the only one to be born at home via water birth.
So yeah, we have run the full gamut of delivery scenarios.
Frankel feels that the first two births were taken from her by the strict policies of hospitals and insurance companies.
The difference between having a hospital birth and a home birth and care by home birth midwives is this sort of sentiment of feeling defeated and sorrowful for those first couple of births, but then with this last pregnancy, very informed and prepared.
Frankel isn't alone in her advocacy of home birth over hospital birth.
My name is Tara Kenny, and I'm a certified professional midwife. I'm also a lactation counselor, an infant massage instructor, and a birth doula and a postpartum doula.
A lot of titles, all saying one thing. Kenny is a professional in home birth. She was one of Frankel's midwives. But Kenny is not a nurse. She says it's difficult to be a non-nurse midwife in the state of Massachusetts, where certified professional midwives, like Kenny, can't get licensed.
It's definitely not on the radar. It's not a mainstream, accessible, you know, choice. We are working with legislation right now to try to just get a board created in order to be able to start the process of regulating, which hopefully then insurances will recognize, you know, our work and therefore be able to cover it.
Kenny says licensing non-nurse midwives alongside nurse midwives would give women more options and cut costs. A typical hospital birth costs $10,000 to $20,000, depending on the procedures. Kenny says home birth is much more cost efficient.
I charge $3,500 for everything, and if you look at that cost, it's nothing. So in terms of health care, we would be saving a lot of money.
But Mass General OBGYN Aaron Tracy says legislation to create a board of midwifery should not be allowed to pass. Tracy represents the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, or ACOG. ACOG maintains that certified nurse midwives should be the only midwives licensed by the state.
Our focus about this legislation is about the training and competence of the providers. This is a bill about licensing individuals that we don't feel are adequately trained to practice medicine.
Tara Kenny says concerns about training are unfounded.
It's a totally different route of training, and in some ways I feel like it's even more thorough than, you know, some of the certified nurse midwives who've just finished school and been thrown into a hospital to practice.
Dr. Eugene DeClercq is a Boston University professor of community health sciences and the lead author of Listening to Mothers. He says that in Massachusetts, even nurse midwives, who would typically align with the OBGYN community on the issue of training, are siding with non-nurse midwives.
Over the last 10 years or so, the action, the excitement among consumers has been for certified professional midwives, not nurse midwives. And so what the Massachusetts midwives came to agree on was, let's take advantage of that, and let's all work together to advance the cause of midwifery, which actually makes all the sense in the world.
DeClercq thinks nurse and non-nurse midwives are working together in Massachusetts because they're trying to change the philosophy of obstetrics care. He says that each choice from OB to nurse midwife to non-nurse midwife has its benefits.
The irony is that mothers are probably safer with a certified professional midwife at a home birth than a doctor at a home birth, simply because of the lack of experience that doctors would have in that setting. It's not that they don't have tons of training and aren't great at what they do. They don't do this.
Back at her home in Newton, Jen Frankel agrees with DeClercq. She experienced in-hospital and at-home birth and found the latter to be better for her. But she believes it really should come down to women having a range of safe options.
I don't want to sound like somebody who's out to bash hospital birth and the general obstetric community. I do feel that it is very important that we have those medical professionals for cases of emergency. But in the case of, you know, healthy, low-risk pregnancy, home birth is a very safe option.
Okay. Are she?
Oh, my God. It's a boy.
It's a boy.
It's a boy. Oh,
whether or not home birth practiced by non-nurse midwives really is safe enough will be left up to the Massachusetts legislature in the spring. In the meantime, baby Nolan's brother Nate and sister Emma are happy to remind us of just how miraculous birth is, at home or in a hospital.
Mama, why are your tummy so squishy?
Because there's no baby in it anymore.
I'm so glad I'm another OB.
You're very good at it.
Student reporter Celie Hart bringing to a close tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Rick Daschle, Tom McClough, Roxanne Palmer, Christina Sorensen, Tinker Reddy, Kate Steger, and Celie Hart. Special thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who edited their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largy with help from Tim Skog and Jared Mooney. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.